I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, that is Transcend. Now, for many of you listening, you are probably working the same brutal shifts that I did for 14 years, suffering from sleep deprivation, body composition challenges, mental health challenges, libido, hair loss, etc. Now, when it comes to the world of hormone replacement and peptide therapy, what I have seen is a shift from doctors telling us that we were within normal limits, which was definitely incorrect, all the way to the other way now, where men's clinics are popping up left, right, and center. So I myself wanted to find a reputable company that would do an analysis of my physiology and then offer supplementations without ramming, for example, hormone replacement therapy down my throat. Now, I came across Transcend because they have an altruistic arm, and they were a big reason why the 7X project I was a part of was able to proceed because of their generous donations. They also have the Transcend Foundations, where they're actually putting military and first responders through some of their therapies at no cost to the individual. So my own personal journey so far, filled in the online form, went to Quest, got blood drawn, and a few days later, I'm talking to one of their wellness professionals as they guide me through my results and the supplementation that they suggest. In my case specifically, because I transitioned out the fire service 5 years ago and been very diligent with my health, my testosterone was actually in a good place. So I went down the peptide route and some other supplements to try and maximize my physiology, knowing full well the damage that 14 years of shift work has done. Now, I also want to underline, because I think this is very important, that each of the therapies they offer, they will talk about the pros and cons. So for example, a lot of first responders in shift work, our testosterone will be low, but sometimes nutrition, exercise, and sleep can offset that on its own. So this company is not going to try and push you down a path, especially if it's one that you can't come back from. So whether it's libido, brain fog, inflammation, gut health, performance, sleep, this is definitely one of the most powerful tools in the toolbox. So to learn more, go to transcendcompany.com or listen to episode 808 of the Behind the Shield podcast with founder Ernie Colling. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5-11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5-11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5-11, who they stand for, and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5-11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show psychologist and author, Dr. Ken Druck. Now, in this second conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his new book, How We Go On, grief in the stages of life, mental health in our children, aging, trauma in Gaza, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredibly powerful and important conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. and this is a free library of over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show Dr. Ken Druck. Enjoy. Well, Ken, I want to start by welcoming you back to the Behind the Shield podcast. We spoke pretty much a year ago now. And, you know, as we were talking before we hit record, the world has continued to exhibit many, many problems. I would argue a lot of mental health problems. So we got a lot of things, interesting things to talk about. But I want to start by welcoming you back onto the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thank you again for being generously inviting me into your living room. And to meet with all the good people that are following this incredible podcast.
So I want to start. We were just talking a moment ago, and it's funny because it kind of made me think about the latest t-shirt that I made for the podcast. Every so often, I just make a single design, and then when they're all gone, they're gone. But the last couple were about kind of ownership, lives depend on you, that kind of thing. And then the last time I had this thought that just popped in my head, and the writing on the back says self-care and sabotage. And you literally used some of that verbiage a second ago. The reason I made this, and it's like a heart with a grenade pin in it as a design, is exactly that. I've witnessed myself play this seesaw my whole life. And there's times where I'm not drinking and I'm hydrating and I'm meditating and doing all the things. And there's other times where, you know, I'm just crashing and burning for a while. So I would love, you know, just while we're on this subject, talk to me about that tug of war of the self-care side and the sabotage.
You know, years ago, James, I began to, you know, understand that I knew what to do. It's like, I don't need another lecture on self-care. You know, I know what to do. I know to hydrate. Like, just like what you were saying, I just don't do it. Or I've got things operating inside of me that kind of sabotage. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I discovered that I have an oppositional, defiant voice in me because I work really hard during the day. And that voice in me comes out and says at the end of the day, you know, go ahead. You go ahead to the freezer and visit Ben and Jerry. They love you unconditionally. They've never said no to you. You eat as much as you want of that sweet stuff, you know, or you do this, or you can drink as much, or you can do whatever. But it was kind of an oppositional defiant, a saboteur, a part of me that knows what the right thing to do is, but doesn't do it. Because that's the way I've learned how to thank myself, appreciate myself, rest myself, reward myself, is through emotional eating or emotional drinking or emotional whatever it is. Pick your favorite, sex, drugs, rock and roll. So I started really drilling down to what about the part of me that does emotional eating that suffers the consequence of too much? What about my knees that hurt when I start putting on too many pounds? What about my heart? What about the part of me that wants to be a grandpa? I have two beautiful grandsons. And I don't want to be the dead grandpa. You know, some of us have had, we got the, oh, where's grandpa? Oh, grandpa died. Because grandpa didn't take care of himself. I don't want to be the dead grandpa or the grandpa in the chair who can't get up out of the chair and go and play with the kids and kick a soccer ball or whatever it is. So for me, I started getting grounded in what do I want the good, what's the good result so that I can rebalance the oppositional oppositional part of me with the part of me that has to suffer the consequences, that doesn't hold that high enough as a goal, that I'm not going to be the dead grandpa, or I'm not going to be the person who's exhausted, burned out, depleted, whose neurotransmitters are singed at every edge, who's burning the candle at both. How do I understand that I can, I have the power, I have the ability, and I have the time and the motivation to take better care of myself? How do I get there? And that's what I did. And I showed you before that to anybody, I love and honor and appreciate all responders and people who, like me, have devoted a great part of their life. And I wrote the self-care handbook, and I will take, anybody goes to my website and get a free copy of that. All you got to do is tell me, you know, I saw Ken on, Behind the Shield, and I heard about the offer. All I got to do is tell you that I want it, and you'll send it to me. Anyhow, so the self-care saboteurs are the things we need to get a handle on. That's what I did. I said, what do I do? What are my self-care saboteurs? So in this book, which I think you guys will have fun with, and by the way, I have no need to sell this, but I'm just sharing it with you. There are the keys to mastering self-care, but there's also the saboteurs. Here are the saboteurs. Here are some of them. So, you know, you look at never enough perfectionism, or the idea that we're feelings of undeservedness or unworthiness, or when we allow guilt, shame, fear, or embarrassment to shut us down from doing what we need to do for ourselves, or the feeling that we're taking food out of somebody else's mouth, or we're crapping out, we're copping out, you know, we're in an abusive relationship with a partner or a coworker or a boss who insists that we leave nothing for ourselves and doesn't understand that longevity, health, and our best possible performance comes from balancing rest and activity, balancing self-care with hard work, and so on. So I started confronting all these saboteurs, and the result is that I'm taking better care of myself. So we have a choice. We can either wait until there's a crisis, we go in for our annual physical, and somebody says, you've got a life-threatening illness, or our partner says, I can't go on this way, or we reach an existential crisis or some kind of a change in our life, and we can wait until the moment of crisis where we have to do something different to take care of ourselves. Or we can be proactive. We can create a clear vision of what it is, what the good result is that we want in our life, and begin to align our behavior, the way we think, the way we act, with that good result to get it, because we deserve it.
I read a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield a while ago. I'm writing the second book at the moment, and it's been extremely hard, because the first one was a nonfiction. This is a fiction now. And he talks about the resistance. And I thought it was such an incredible kind of perspective that when you're feeling that resistance, that's because what you're trying to do is very important. And then I was just talking to someone yesterday in an interview, and it kind of dawned on me, well, does that apply in other areas too? You know, is there, you know, that kind of resistance to the health, to the exercise for some people, because unbeknownst to them, it's actually really important. And that's where that pushback is coming from. From a psychological perspective, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a continuum. On one extreme is complete avoidance. We spend our lives trying to hide, deny, repress, avoid, dumb down, numb out, really, and go into denial and avoidance. And we just try to skip around every challenge, every adversity, every loss, every what now moment in our lives. All of us and everybody we know is going through some kind of a what now moment or what if moment. Whether we meet that moment in our lives, or whether we live in avoidance, and the avoidance that I was talking about, or whether we meet it, defines the quality of our lives, quality of our health, the quality of our relationships. and our character, the quality of our character, whether we're living in integrity or we're so completely out of alignment because we're not living in the truth of the way things really are and the way things really work. We're not using what we know. We're so fearful. So we have the choice. In every moment of life, in every day of life, we have the choice to meet those what now moments. And the what now moment could be that we've suffered a loss. It could be what now because I'm working in a job. I'm doing work that is depleting me. I don't wake up looking forward to life. Or a what now moment might be something we're afraid to bring up in our relationship because, you know, it could open a can of worms. So we avoid it. It's that courageous conversation that we've been avoiding with our partner, that if only we could have that and take ownership for our part, not to sit there and blame. It's like, you know, I've got to talk to you. Here are 10 things you're doing wrong. And here's the way you're not making me happy. And it's your fault. And, you know, no, I want to start the conversation with, I'm feeling scared, or I'm feeling cheated, or I'm feeling lost or confused or uncertain or unloved or undervalued or whatever it is, whatever you need to say is the feeling. And then to say, here's my part in it. I don't talk to you. I don't bring it up to you. I'm even scared to talk to you about it now because I'm afraid that it's going to unleash a whole bunch of complaints and concerns and, you know, problems with you. And I'm going to get punished for having brought it up. You're going to hijack my transparency, my disclosure, and into a whole bunch of complaints that you've had that you haven't shared with me. So I think it's important to be able to meet whatever kind of moment our life is presenting us on whatever track, and to do so courageously. Life asks us to summon newfound courage. You know, you think back, who's the guy who did some of the things that I've done in the past, who had the bravery to do some of the things? Where did he find that? Well, he brought it up from within himself or herself. They summoned the courage, the strength, the bravery to meet that what now moment and to train themselves how to do that. And life continues to bring up all kinds of new opportunities and new, as you get older, there's the what now moment. Like, when did this happen? I turned 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 or 90. You know, what now? I'm realizing that life is a lease deal. So I'm going through this existential angst that my God, my life is going to end one day. That really happens. It's like, okay, there's a what now moment. Am I going to meet that moment, or am I going to learn to run like hell from that moment? Am I going to summon the strength, the courage to think about how life does go on and how I'm going to live vibrant, beautiful, visionary, joyful, purposeful, meaningful years right up until my ride is over? So I think we have a choice. We don't get to choose some things about this life, the way this life unfolds. But we do get to have the choice about whether we're going to be the person who summons the courage and the faith and the strength and the humility and the honesty to meet the moments of our lives, whatever they are, whatever they are. And we all have, they're different for each one of us. Might even be dealing with something in the past. The what now moment might be, what about then? What about what happened? How can I repair? How can I apologize? How can I make amends? How can I ask for forgiveness? How can I give forgiveness? So it's, life presents us with unlimited opportunities to show up.
So your new book, How We Go On, you know, you have it kind of segmented almost through the lifeline, as you just talked about, the finite age of a human being.
Yes.
In our last conversation, which for everyone was episode 750, so 3/4 of the way to 1,000, we talked about a host of issues. I mean, obviously, you know, losing your daughter tragically at 21 years old, and then your grief as a parent and how that led you down this path now. And we talked about some of the school shootings and 9/11 and the ripple effects of those. There's been a realization, it was literally something that a guest of Joe Rogan said, like on the fly. I think Joe talked about it was Big Pharma or whatever the thing was. And this gentleman had said, they're hurting too. And I'd never thought of it that way. We struggle to understand why the heads of, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, or tobacco companies, or fast food, or politicians, or some of these frivolous lawsuit lawyers, whoever it is, don't feel. And as we've progressed through with the mental health conversation, you understand how distorted the brain gets sometimes, which then leads people into suicidal ideation, possibly even homicidal ideation. To me, it seems like that's a big missing piece of this whole conversation, is I really believe there's a lot of mental ill health in politics, because how could a compassionate human being go to sleep at night knowing that they just sent a bunch of people off to war, or that their pain pills are killing people in, West Virginia? So what is your perspective of that? Because I've never really heard that talked about. This is one comment on this one interview, but the mental health crisis extending to the very people that are supposed to be leaders in all these different fields.
I think some of the ways we model good mental health or bad mental health are all over the place. You have people, instead of owning up to their part in what's not working the way it needs to, you have people casting blame, forming conspiracies, pointing out in as many ways as possible how somebody else is responsible for the problem. And that sets up the polarization. So you have people, you have a country that is splintered in half. In the US, you have two sides. There are very few people in dialogue. Even with what's going on right now in the Middle East, I've been working with organizations that have been bringing together Israeli and Palestinian families for 30 years. They've been working hard. They've humanized to one another. They haven't objectified those Palestinians, those Israelis, those Jews, those Muslims. They've humanized. They've found the common ground on which they all love their families, on which they don't want to they don't want to recycle the hatred, the objectification, that what they are doing to honor their losses and what they've been through and the trauma they've suffered is to prevent one other family from having to suffer the way their family has because of a loss, because of the hatred, because of the violence, because they objectified. And what you find, unfortunately, and you find it, I'm just going to be honest with you, disproportionately on one side of the ledger in the US, you find somebody who has severe mental health issues, who I've known for over 55 years, who is leading the band, who has set the tone. And you have a lot of people who are extremely suggestible, believing that that's the way to be a man. That's the way to run a country. That's the way to solve our problems. And it's tragic because it's led us down a dark and dangerous path. So you have somebody with very questionable mental health, very questionable mental health, setting the tone and being an example. Our kids, we want our kids to follow that. somebody who is into name calling, somebody who is into that kind of blame, condemnation, objectification, you know, who assassinates people's character, who's not honest about his own, who's corrupt and not honest about his own life. So I think that has set a dangerous precedent. And then I think we also have, we live in a quick fix world. We don't understand that some mental health issues, it's like grief. You and I talked about grief and loss at the last time. And I told you how I teach grief literacy. I teach young psychiatrists at the University of California, San Diego. I've taught grief literacy at the Harvard School of Public Health. I give talks, lectures all over the world about grief and loss, which is something all of us go through. And instead of trying to deny and quick fix, have you gotten over it? Instead of doing the things that perpetuate the pain, that prolong the pain and the suffering of a loss, instead of giving the people we care about the support and understanding that they need and the time in a judgment-free zone, we want to know, are you over it? Have you gotten over it? We want to give them quick fix solutions. Well, you know, she's in a better place. You know, and let's do the spiritual bypass. And instead of being with people, we try to figure it out and fix them quick, because grief is messy business. Well, mental health is also messy business. So we want people who are depressed or anxious or who've suffered trauma to get over it. What's your problem? It's been a year. It's been 5 years. It's been 10 years. How come you're not getting over it? What's wrong with your operating system? You know, so-and-so got over it. What's your problem? We diminish people. We conduct a courtroom exercise with only an admonishing prosecutor, no defense attorney, no voice. And that in the core of this new book, James, which I think you're going to love, is take your foot off of your throat and put your hand on your heart. When your foot is on your throat, it's pressure, it's impatience, it's harsh self-criticism, it's condemnation, it's blame, it's denial. If you're living by telling yourself things, talking to yourself, it's like, what's my problem? Look at me. What an idiot I am. How could I have missed that? Or what did I do wrong? How come I can't get over it? Catch yourself here and move that hand down to your heart. Because when we speak to ourselves with compassion, it's like, how could I not feel that way? How could I not continue to miss my daughter? It's been 27 years since she died. The critical part of me would say, what the hell is your problem? It's been 27 years. But the heart doesn't know from years. The heart doesn't measure love in years or yearning or missing or grief. So it's, how could I not, when I see a young girl with her hair, or when one of her friends calls me to tell me she had a kid or she's now the vice president of her company, and how could I not feel like, oh, my daughter's life was lost to her. And it was lost to me and her sister, who tells her kids stories about their aunt who died. You know, how could we not? So compassion, patience, the hand on our heart is patience. It says, you know, this is taking as long as it takes. And if there's something I can do to help myself heal, I need to do it. It's not going to happen by magic. There's no quick fix. It's not going to happen by shaming myself, beating the crap out of myself, or listening to somebody on the radio or TV who's telling me I need to get over it, that there's some quick fix, that I'm just not using it. They're the expert. So moving that simple change from talking to ourselves and treating ourselves, instead of doing it with pressure, harsh self-criticism, condemnation, with kindness, patience, understanding, support, encouragement, love, forgiveness, understanding more than anything. This is what I'm going through. How could I not be feeling this? And what, because that leads to the creative solutions. If somebody's got a gun to our head, how can we be thinking about what we can do to help ourselves? We're so busy beating the crap out of ourselves that we can't say, all right, let's do some good things to help ourselves. Let's ask, you know, the least utilized word in the male vocabulary starts with an H. It's the word help. How can I get the help that I need? It's okay to get the help. I don't need to shame myself or belittle. You know what? Help is a good thing. There are people who have great tools and abilities and understanding that I'm not able to give myself yet. It's okay to look to them for support and resources and tools until I learn how to care for myself in this way. It's okay to read a book. It's okay to listen to a great podcast like this one, where somebody's providing all the possible tools and reason why we can heal and help ourselves. We can clear the path forward to our best possible future rather than living stuck, living in suffering, living in despair, living in the dark night.
You hit on, you know, an unnamed person, but this is something that I've observed as well. You know, the thing that's missing from any campaign, apart from what they actually stand for, is kindness and compassion and community and pulling people together, not forcing them apart. Exactly. And when you look at the system, because I mean, I have been, you know, disgusted certainly in the last 8+ years of who we've been presented. And out of 330 million people, we keep hearing the lesser of two evils. Well, that should never happen when you have such a large pool to choose from. But when you look at the kind of human being that would thrive in a selection process where you firstly have to be a millionaire or billionaire, and secondly, the lobbyists are going to fund your campaign, and then there's, you know, in return, you're going to do all these favors. It's the people without good mental health that are going to get through the top of that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I've always, you know, I've been talking about is it's not about politics. We're all Americans, and there's been this division. And just like you said, and yet when you talk to most people, 80%+ of us are actually in the middle. We just kind of been pulled one way or another, but most people want the same exact thing. So what is your perspective of the way that we choose these people, and what can we do? I mean, I want to get to the ownership of the individual, but while we're talking about this, what does that need to look like so the real good human beings, the good leaders of the US, can actually succeed in a selection process?
Yeah. You know, many of us have lived in families where there was somebody like the individual we're talking about. They are unreachable. They've got a narrative looping in their brain. They are entitled, they are arrogant, and they are narcissistic. And they have no infrastructure. They have arrogance, an inflated sense of themselves, a lot of lies, a lot of exaggerations, because they have no infrastructure. And when they begin to confront reality, the consequences of what they've done, the people they've hurt in the family, the things they've done that have gone sideways, they free fall into tremendous despair, because there's nothing in the middle that says, hey, you can do better than this. Hey, tell the truth. Hey, you have a part in this. Hey, apologize. Hey, be responsible. Leave a legacy of love, not one of chaos and division. So there's nothing in the middle to guide them They are just operating from here up. There's no soul. There's no compassion. There's no empathy. Now, some of these people I've known, you know a little bit about my background. I'm from New York. I know a lot of these people. I've known them. I've coached some of them. And I can tell you that in many of them, there is an emptiness, a toxic emptiness that gets filled in dangerous ways. You know, it's the emptiness of fascism, of leaders. And we can see them. Putin is another one. The man has no heart, no soul. So there are people and organizations, individuals, and cultures that have cultivated an indifference to the pain of other people. And there are people in our own families this way. And they are unreachable, but it requires us to have the courage, first of all, to wake up. Some of us have drank the Kool-Aid. We looked for the quick fix solution, the easy to blame person. We mounted it with the whole narrative in our head is an interpretation. We believe it's the truth. And it's the furthest thing in the world from the truth. The truth starts with our own honesty about our own feelings, about how scared we are about what's happening in our country, or how frightening it is to not know what's happening as a result of immigration, or what's happening as fentanyl comes across the border, or what's happening, you know, in the Middle East or in Ukraine and Russia and all this dialogue, all these interpretations, what's happening in our own Congress, in our own government, the degree of corruption or distortion or polarization. So I think it's up to us to have the courage and clarity to get educated about the truth. What's the truth here? And nobody's perfect. It's very easy. You know, we've outed so many things in the last 8 years, as you've said. We've outed the degree of racism we have in our culture that we thought we were much further down the road on the road of equality, of people knowing we're all God's children. We have outed the fear, the terror, and the threat that a lot of people feel with LGBTQ, with people who are different interpretations of their gender and their attraction to other people and their biology. We've outed anti-Semitism, the hatred. We've licensed people to hate Jews. Let's hate them. You know, those Jews, we've got all these narratives. They're historical narratives. And now we've outed aged bias. That Joe Biden, you know, he's slurring his words. He's, you know, in our families, some of us dismiss the elders in our families because they've slowed down or they slur a word or they tell a story twice or three times. And here we are, and yet they have such a richness and such a depth and such experience and good judgment. And here we are using everything in our power, some people are, to dismiss and marginalize a man who's actually done some great things in the most difficult time in our history, who's done some good things. Is he perfect? No. Could we pick him apart if that's our agenda? We could pick any human being apart. Any human being. If we put that microscope on them, we can find fault. We're all a work in progress. So for me, it starts with waking up out of, if we've been drinking the Kool-Aid, to wake up and get educated and find out what's really going on. Second, to align ourselves with and elect and vote for leaders, visionary leaders who bring us, as you said, together. Who have compassion, There's room enough. There's compassion enough to say people are hurting in Israel. People are hurting in Gaza. People are hurting in America. People are hurting in all of our cities. People of every race, every background, every religion. How can we show the kindness that we're learning to treat ourselves with? How can we show them the kindness, the generosity of heart, the understanding, the support? Because isn't there enough to go around? Have we really tapped the resources to bring stability, to create homes for the homeless? We haven't begun to tap the resources. And if we're we're part of the problem because we're acting greedy, or we've aligned ourselves with people who don't think there's enough to go around, or to show compassion, support, and understanding to other people. And by the way, I'm not saying we shouldn't be tough love too. Damn it, let's set up healthy boundaries where they need to be, on the border, in our lives, in our families, with people we have relationships with that are out of control, that would exploit us, that have other agendas other than our own well-being. Let's do tough love, but let it come from that place of compassion, strength, and understanding.
Well, speaking of compassion, strength, and understanding, I just had an incredible man on the show, Dr. Thea Ahmad, who is a ER physician in Chicago, Southside, and just spent a few weeks in Gaza with a group of humanitarians he went over with. And it was such a beautiful conversation. At the beginning, he talked about how an Israeli surgeon, cardiologist, had saved his father's life when he was younger. And then he talks about when he first landed, he went to Jerusalem. And there were Jews and Muslims and Christians all praying side by side. And he made the observation that, look, we can, you know, coexist here. And then he goes to Gaza and obviously sees the other side and, you know, this the systematic kind of flattening of the entire area. And he's, again, coming from humanitarian lens. And, you know, he talked about the atrocities of October 7th and how those people were victimized. But the truth in the middle is innocent people being affected by this. So you're talking about working with this organization for decades. Kind of what has been the push and what is the resistance that group is receiving from uniting, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians in that area?
You're a person who knows a lot about trauma. So we need to start the conversation by talking about trauma. I've been working with the families and the kids whose friends went to a concert, whose friends were raped and kidnapped, who knew families, and I've also been contacted and been working with some of the kibbutzes where 120 people were murdered, slaughtered, where their babies were put in ovens and murdered, young children, infants. The degree of savagery and brutality that exceeds some of what was done in the dark ages of human history has traumatized a nation that has been fighting for its own existence for history, throughout history, has created a level of trauma where the idea that has to be understood, not necessarily how we're going about that business, hurting, killing, destroying the lives of innocent people is not the answer. That collateral damage is not the answer, needs to be attended. Re-traumatizing the other side so that now another five generations of kids and their families are going to be caught in that vicious cycle of unprocessed grief and violence That's the way it recycles. Indifference, objectification of the other person, indifference to their pain and suffering, and trauma and more violence, because unprocessed grief becomes violence. So there are two elements. Number one, the trauma of what happened, the savagery of what happened, the barbaric savagery. And the second thing is the kidnapping. What perpetuates and what I wished there was the strength, and maybe it is, and it's getting suppressed in Gaza, of the people saying, you kidnapped 130 of their people are still here kidnapped. How could they not be doing something? What they're doing is hurting us. Will you please, we're compelling you, we're forcing you to create peace, to return the hostages, because that is the step towards peace. If you really care about us and our families and our children and don't want to see more of us die, please do something other than holding hostages. That's not working for us. And of course, the Israelis have a side. Both sides are perpetuating the problem. And both sides need to come together, but it's going to be the start of that. And hopefully this coming weekend, there's going to be some very important peace discussion, peace deliberations. But hopefully both come with the understanding, the compassion, the empathy, and the understanding about the trauma, the murderous rage that was rained upon a people, what started this, and this new wave of violence, and the fact that it's perpetuated, that it's not going, it's being, the re-traumatization is happening every day because there are families waiting for their loved ones to come home. And now that is perpetuating on the other side, the trauma of thousands of people losing family members, innocent people who only wanted peace. You know, one of the greatest tragedies in the beginning of all this, because you know now that I've been working with a lot of the families in both organizations of Palestinian and Israeli families, and with kids who are in Israel taking their gap year in high school, and with some of the kibbutz, the people who were in kibbutzes that were assaulted. But what I think is critically important in the equation of all this is how do we put in front in leadership roles the people who forged peace, who are praying together? How do we show that? How do we portray that in our news media? How can we show the organizations that are heartsick? There's an organization that's been based in San Diego called Hands of Peace. They bring Israeli and Palestinian kids together every year into San Diego for 3 weeks, and they all go home as visionary leaders, saying, I can't, from now on, I cannot objectify the Israeli kids that are my age. I cannot objectify the Palestinian kids that are my age. They're human beings with families just like me. So how we find that common ground, how we elevate leaders who understand it, who we vote for, how we negotiate, who we send into those negotiations is going to be critical to creating that kind of peace. It's a different situation in Israel and Ukraine because you have somebody who's unreachable. You have somebody who is psychotic, in my opinion, who's operating on an unreachable, beyond disordered, you know, homicidal maniac, who's also brilliant. Like a lot of these leaders, they're brilliant at marketing. They're brilliant at politicking, what they do and selling it and creating a storyline that gains them some degree of popularity.
There's been many times in history, and I know Iraq and Palestine had a near peace treaty, you know, a few decades ago, and then there was assassination. Martin Luther King, assassination. JFK, assassination. One of the leaders of the Mujahideen that was bringing everyone together, assassination again. Talk to me about that. It seems like when we do get those, the people that we need to be up front, more often than not, they're removed from society in the most horrible way.
That's right. Yep. There are those who don't want peace. There are those who want to continue the war. Look, there are people in our own families and communities who thrive on chaos and war and division. And whether it's whether they have a religious affiliation with white nationalism, whether who knows what drives it, but there are people in our communities that believe that that is the way to deal with it, to perpetuate the chaos. They would be lost in a world of peace. Their personalities, their beliefs, their whole, what gives life meaning for them is to be victims. They're somebody's victims. You know, and what they don't realize, when I said sometimes people need to awaken, it's because they've become useful idiots. Now, the world's top useful idiot is a man who used to be president. Most people don't realize that. He is the useful idiot of people within our own country, people within our own government. He's just the face of it all. He's Putin's useful idiot. He's the useful idiot of other world leaders. America's useful idiots. And those people that follow that track, that way of operating in the world, that worldview, I've been honored enough to meet those who have awakened from the coma, who've stopped drinking the Kool-Aid and say, I can't do this anymore. I can't follow this track anymore. He's finally gone too far. Because the question I ask is, what would have to happen? What would have to happen that would get you to see, you know, maybe what I'm saying is a lie. Maybe I'm the crazy one. Maybe I'm the one who's out of touch with reality. But what would have to happen? And ask me the same question. What would have to happen that would get me to awaken and see that it's really the other way?
Well, I think we need a good leader. The problem was the one that followed him was awful in a bunch of different ways. I mean, you know, I've got many, many first responder friends that gave everything at the beginning of COVID and then were terminated because of vaccine requirements, you know, a year later. You know what I mean? No one stood behind them. So again, I saw that that cleaving, you know, continue. It had a different color tie, absolutely. But that division was still perpetuated with the one that we have at the moment as well.
Without an apology to say, I might have been mistaken, as many leaders have. There are some wonderful visionary leaders in our country. They're younger. They understand. They know when to apologize for a mistake or a misjudgment. They would say to all the responders, looking back at what happened and how we handled it, boy, there were some options we didn't exercise, and we owe you not only an apology, but an opportunity to pay you back for what you lost, if that's at all possible. So, you know, there are humble, having humility, having a leader with humility and the capacity, or a family member for that matter, who shows humility and the capacity to apologize or to admit a mistake or to say, my part in, you know, the good parts that I feel proud of were here, but the parts that I don't feel proud of and that I'm questioning how I handle that situation, are here. And that's what a good visionary leader is. It's somebody with the ability to self-correct, the ability to admit a mistake, the ability to try to make it up, you know, because sometimes an apology isn't enough. Sometimes, you know, I'm sorry is, it's nice, but it's not enough. It's, I'm sorry, how could I make it up to you? I'd like to do something that would show you my desire, my remorse, my understanding of what this cost you. What could I do that could begin to make it up to you? Because if it's possible, I'll do it. And so, and that's what heals our relationships and our families, our marriages, with our kids, with our parents, our aging parents, and in our communities. It's people who come to the table in the spirit of collaboration, reconciliation, peace, and are ready to let's build this country back strong together. It's going to take both of us. Let's build it together. A couple of years ago, I started a book. I didn't finish it. It was called Unlikely Friendships. Because I have several friends. I disagree with them vehemently, politically. We disagree. They see it completely different. We have a lot of common ground, a lot of things we both believe in and support. But there are a lot of things we disagree in. And I call those unlikely friendships. But we learn from each other. We have an agreement. Don't send me anything to try to tell me I'm wrong, to beat me up and to tell me, you know. But if there's something that would illuminate my understanding of some of the things we've talked about, and it's given in good faith, then please send it to me, and I'll read it, and I'll be grateful. And that's the condition under which we conduct our unlikely friendship. We need more unlikely friendships. Yeah, we're all, it's going to happen with all of us working together.
Absolutely. Well, you talked about humility as well. And I think that's a huge piece that's missing in, and I'm not talking even at the national level. It could be at the fire department level, the officer of just an engine or the actual department, but it takes a lot of courage to be humble, I think. And it takes even more courage to say, as you just touched on, you know what, I was wrong. And it's insanity, because you think about the political landscape, people use the words wishy-washy, and you know, they go back to something that someone said 20 years ago. Well, I started this podcast only 7 years ago. I think completely different now after 900 conversations than I did back then. So there's lots of times where I've gone back and gone, oh, wow, I didn't, you know, that was wrong the way you used to talk about that. We didn't know. And I like that term as well. They did the best with what they had. That's what we've got to remember as well. But to just put, just say, I've changed my mind. That is a superpower. But it's almost like there's so much fear around that, because people look at that as like, oh, well, then you don't know how you think. Yes, you do. It's okay. It's a metamorphosis. When you were six, you weren't having geopolitical conversations or, you know, doing whatever it is that your specialty is in your occupation now. We constantly evolve. And I think that humility piece, which goes completely against, obviously, narcissism, which is what we normally find, at the helm these days, it's the humility that is so important.
We're so quick to condemn. We're all works in progress. It's so easy to condemn. I have to tell you a quick story that really lights that issue up. So last year, my wife said, she's had this bucket list issue. She says, I want to go see the mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Okay, we're going to go see the mountain gorillas in Rwanda. We go to Rwanda, which is a place where there was genocide 25, 30 years ago. You've never seen a more transformed country in your life.
Really?
Clean. They devote one day a month. The whole country picks up any piece of trash, paper, cans. There's nothing on the streets. It's impeccably clean. They have really transformed their country. There are green fields of crops growing everywhere. There is peace everywhere. people understand that it's changed. And so I went up, I did the first day, I hiked to 11,000 feet in the rain. I saw the gorillas. I had an incredible experience. We had 2 days booked. My wife was going to go up the second day. And I said, you know what? You go. I'm going to go on an adventure. And so I went with the guide, another one of the guides who I really liked. I said, take me up. I heard about this group that lives up at 10,000 feet called the Gorilla Guardians. I want you to take me up because I want to meet them. Poaching, generations of poachers, families that have gone from generation to generation to generation, poaching gorillas, because that's the way they survived, have now formed a group. There are now dozens of gorilla families on the mountainside. Because these guys have said, instead of poaching the gorillas, we're going to protect them. Even though my family has done this for generations, my family has believed and been able to justify that doing this was the way to survive, take care of your family. We've turned it around. Now they protect the gorillas. I walked into this village. I was introduced to the leader through a translator, and I walked directly up to the leader and I pointed and I said, I am here to honor you. My wife is on the mountain right now, fulfilling a lifelong dream to see the gorillas, the mountain gorillas in their own element because of you. Because of what you've done. And we are enjoying your beautiful country because of you and what you've done and what you've turned around. So I am here to honor you and to thank you. This was all translated to him. All the men started gathering around at the time. What did they start doing? They started singing and dancing. And I started singing and dancing with them. Here I am on the mountaintop, singing and dancing with the gorilla guardians, rejoicing in a change that they were willing to make and honoring them. Instead of condemning them, honoring them. And it gave me a clear sense of that we need to do more honoring in this life.
That is amazing.
We need to learn a lot more about what it means to honor those people who are beginning to open their eyes to another possibility that perpetuates life, not death, not violence, peace, allowing a species to not become extinct. And giving people a chance, a different way to feel prosperous and to take care of their families. And that needs to happen everywhere in all different kinds of expressions. But we have it within us to forge peace. We have it within us to show perhaps the greatest gift we can give each other as human beings is the gift of feeling understood. When you look into somebody's eyes and you say, you really get it. I just said something. You not only listened, you really get it. The experience of feeling understood and met is the basis, the foundation for peace, for coexistence, for resolving our differences. It's not blaming, condemning, beating up, judging, excluding, othering, all those other things which unfortunately are being perpetuated by people who are reckless, and greedy because all they want is their own power and domination over matters. And they believe that's, they play to the people who are afraid. So we need to summon the courage to not be afraid and to venture on that path of peace, that path forward of peace, not of war and conflict and self-righteousness or imposing our beliefs about what this life is and how it all works.
I'm so glad that you told that story. That is incredible. I remember seeing the film Hotel Rwanda, and it was just such a horrendous time. Were you able to find out what changed? Because I know it was tribal, wasn't it? So
leadership. Visionary leader. And again, this leader didn't do everything right. Talk about tough love. There was a lot of tough love. There were consequences for people who were perpetuating misinformation, corruption, greed, who were not taking care of the people of the country, who are hoarding it all, the oligarchs. And the leadership said, this is my vision for what's possible. Let's create a safe, prosperous nation where people are getting along together. And those people who don't want to live by those rules will meet consequences. They will be invited to go play somewhere else. So I love the idea of a visionary leader who has a clear, positive picture and creates the opportunity and also creates a clear sense of consequences for people who are going to try to undermine. It's not a dictatorship. It's not an autocracy. It's just saying, here are the rules we're going to play by. Here's how this works, and here's how it doesn't work.
Have you ever been to Haiti?
Yes.
So I haven't been to Haiti. I will say not at the actual real Haiti, but we cruise quite a lot because we're in Florida. And there is a port, Labadee, which I think is an outcropping of Haiti.
Yeah.
I have never seen such a beautiful part of the world. I mean, obviously, there's beauty in different ways. But I mean, if you talk about island beauty, that Labadee section is it. And it breaks my heart. And I worked with some Haitian guys when I first moved to the US and was working in Miami. And they would talk about, you know, Baby Doc and Papa Doc and, you know, all the corruption. But it's so sad because they just industry, I mean, just tourism alone, just even if it was just cruise ship, you know what I mean? There's the potential for that island to thrive. And it's so heartbreaking to see this
on the planet. Yes.
Yeah. So talk to me about that. Cause again, you know, that if I'm understanding it right, there's basically no leadership there at all. It's kind of chaos. So what have you seen through that lens with that island? Because that seems like a place that could really learn from Rwanda, for example.
Yeah. I haven't been to Haiti in many, many years. And I see the same heartbreaking stories of corruption and violence and suffering and poverty. It's heartbreaking. The leadership, the absence of leadership, and like you said, the people who try to rise up as leaders who are assassinated, who are killed, who are threatened, who are intimidated, who are talked off the stage. You know, here we are living in the era, the fresh wound of losing somebody like Alexei Navalny, a man who gave his life, didn't walk away, gave his life, said, I am going to give my life. And now his wife has done the same thing because I am unwilling to comply. I cannot be indifferent and turn my back on my people, on the suffering, the injustice, the greed, the corruption. And, you know, I bet there are some amazing leaders in Haiti whose hearts are broken, who are living right on the edge today, fearing for their lives, because those who are determined, if nothing else, to remain in control of the corrupt, of the corruption of what's happened, of hoarding the generosity that's been given to Haiti to repair. You know, and right across on the other side of the island, you have the Dominican Republic. Have you been there?
I haven't yet. That's one place I'm hoping to get to soon.
Beaches and golf courses, beautiful golf courses. Beautiful. I mean, they have corruption and poverty too, but they have walled off these beautiful communities where people live in couple of million dollar homes, right on golf courses, and they have guards all around them. So, you know, we live in a world where in need of tremendous repair. Shortly before my mom's passing, she called me one day. She's a very strong woman with a great background and working in social justice and community. And she called me crying. She had never called me crying. And she said, "I've been watching a lot of television and the world is broken. Do what you can to help fix it, because I'm not going to be here." And I hope it's the mission of a lot of us to become part of the solution, not part of the problem. And it's my mission. That's my mission in this life. I have two young grandsons, and to leave a legacy, the legacy of somebody who tried to become part of the solution, worked hard to become part of the solution, rather than remaining indifferent and becoming part of the problem, perpetuating the polarization, perpetuating the lies, the misinformation, all the reasons we should stay separate, or not being strong enough to draw healthy lines where boundaries needed to be drawn.
One of my guests said something pretty profound about 6 months ago now. He was like, "Remember, America is the poster for democracy. So when you look into this country, what do you see? Is it, you know, something that you're going to want to bring to your country?" And, you know, the principle, the philosophy is beautiful, but as touched on earlier, it's a demostocracy. It's a bunch of wealthy people telling everyone else what to do, even though we're paying them. So it's a distorted version of it. But, you know, when you start fixing the problems in our own borders, for example, you know, the drug prohibition that's empowered the underworld that now has caused all these problems in Colombia, Mexico, you know, that we're so complicit in a lot of suffering in other parts of the world. So for me, when we actually push back and demand, you know, good leadership in all the levels, from our own home all the way through to DC, not only are we healing our own country, but our ability to heal other countries improves. The number of people that are fleeing their own country into ours will diminish, because people will be happier. You know, if Haiti looks like Labadee, you're not going to see many rafts. Not many people are going to leave that beautiful island, you know? So this is the thing. If we really believe in democracy, then we've got to take it back, because it's been hijacked from us.
Yes. I had the honor of meeting with an extraordinary visionary leader 2 days ago. She's the senior United States senator. She was voted the most effective senator in the entire United States Senate. Her name is Amy Klobuchar. And I spent some very important time with her. But it's all of us deciding, listening to those people who are brave enough to run for office or to be serving, and deciding who we believe is on the right track, who's willing to work across the aisle, who's not so stuck in their own party beliefs, but is functioning as a leader with the best ideas, the most effective ideas that are going to create the kind of results that we want. And we need to be discerning. I mean, I was blown away by this woman and everything she's doing, all the bills she's putting, but all the issues she is attacking in such a constructive way. And there are people like her. Cory Booker is another one. We need to find our visionary leaders and support them, because that's how the people that we believe in rise up and are given the power to lead and the opportunity to lead. And in our own communities as well, in our own communities, on our school boards and whatever. And if we see somebody who is bringing a toxic formula, a quick fix, condemning, blaming everybody else, who's incapable of forging community, collaboration, who's just going to be, all people are going to be doing is wasting years trying to mount an attack against that person because they're so toxic. You know, we have joined the problem. We've become part of the problem if we become indifferent. We've got to wake up and fight for our democracy, not if we're smart, but because we're smart, we will do what?
Absolutely.
James, what a joy to be able to talk with you about such important issues in such an open and safe forum and productive forum. And I just want to thank you for the service that you give to all of us. I know it takes moving 1,000 parts to do this. It looks easy. You just kind of you sit behind a microphone and ask great questions. But I know this involves a lot of hard work on your part. And I want to just honor you for your service.
Well, thank you. Likewise. I mean, yeah, the interviews that you've done, and then obviously all the books that you've put out and the work that you shared. And I mean, the number of people that, you know, are doing so much better now because of yours. So I'll send that honoring right back to you. So thank you.
Thank you. And anybody who is interested, go to kendruck.com if you want a free copy of the self-care handbook. I'd be honored to give it to them. And my hope and prayer for everybody is let it start here. Catch yourself here with your foot on your throat and move that hand down to kindness, because compassion for other people begins with compassion for yourself. Kindness, understanding, support, education, awareness, strength, it all begins here. And then what you're projecting into the world isn't blame or condemnation or division. What you're projecting into the world is the greater possibilities for our best possible future.
Absolutely. Well, the book, How We Go On, as I said, you kind of break it down into the life stages. We ended up going all over the place and didn't really touch on it specifically. Where can people find that? Because, you know, again, bringing solutions to problems, You've laid out this beautiful kind of age step element to, You know, how we go on at the different stages of our life.
First of all, became a bestseller in its second week in existence and was endorsed. The cover endorsement is Katie Couric. Maria Shriver loved the book. I did a thing with her, with Arianna Huffington. The book has made its way around the world. It's the best-selling book I've ever written. And it's an audio book. It's an ebook. It's a regular book. People can go to howwegoon.com to order the book, howwegoon.com. And if people want the handbook, the self-care handbook, or to be in touch or to get on my newsletter or anything like that, they can just go to kendruck.com. kendruck.com. Go onto my website and there's a place where you can get a copy of the book sent to your email address.
Brilliant.
Copy of the Handbook of Self-Care.
Fantastic. Well, Ken, I want to say thank you again. I think the last time we talked for like 2.5 hours, now we've got, you know, scraping an hour and a half this time. It's just such a unique perspective. And just to unpack some of these topics, I mean, you know, we did so much in the first conversation. So if people want to really dive into your story and your work, then episode 750 is a must listen to. But now taking all of that perspective and applying it to some of these things that really are affecting every single one of us, I think it was a really powerful conversation. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the podcast today.
Thanks again, James. You stay well, my brother.